Crisis in the Middle East. It's a headline you can write any time you like. There is, in some shape or form, always a crisis in the Middle East, sometimes of local manufacture, sometimes occasioned by outside interference, very often a bit from column A and a bit from column B. The Middle East Crisis Factory is the title of a new book by Iyad El-Baghdadi and Ahmed Gatnash. It looks at how the Middle East became such a prolific producer of chaos, but more importantly makes the case that it does not have to be this way, certainly not forever. This week's episode is an extended conversation with Iyad El-Baghdadi, considering how the recent history of the Middle East has imprisoned its 500 million people, and pondering potential avenues and apparatuses of escape. We'll also speak to Hawla Ben Aicha, a former member of Tunisia's post-Arab Spring Parliament, who has seen firsthand the challenges of changing the Middle East's politics. This is The Foreign Desk.
We had European colonialists telling us that we cannot rule ourselves because we're not ready for self-rule. This was the narrative. We are not civilized enough, we're not, you know, developed enough to be able to rule ourselves. Now we have dictators who are backed by these very countries who tell us that we're not ready for democracy.
As you may know, I mean, all over the world, politics are the territory, if I can say it, of men and of elder people. So whenever I wanted to do something, I was having like an answer, you are too young, you will still have time to do this after, just let the priority to people who have more experience than you, who spend their life having a political career.
Hello and welcome to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. My guest today is Iyad El-Baghdadi, who, together with Ahmed Gatnash, is the author of the book, The Middle East Crisis Factory. I wanted to start by talking about the recent history of the Middle East as it's affected you directly, because your current circumstances are kind of a product of the recent history of the Middle East. So I was wondering if you could talk us through that a bit and explain how it is that you come to be talking to us today from Oslo.
Yeah, that's a good question, and one that is, you know, personally relevant for me. I mean, I had kind of a quiet upbringing, I would say, in the United Arab Emirates. My family really was formed in the United Arab Emirates in the 1970s. And I was born there, and I, you know, Dubai in the 1980s, maybe even into the 1990s, was kind of like one of those best kept secrets. It was boring in a good way, in a sense that it's that one place in this very turbulent region where people could move and they could have a successful career, and there was no instability around the United Arab Emirates. I mean, there was a lot of news about, you know, things happening in Iraq and Iran, but, you know, mostly on that side of the Gulf, things were quiet. My own family, however, came from a much more turbulent history. My father was born shortly before the 1948 Nakba, the exodus of the Palestinians from historical Palestine. My mother herself was born in diaspora in Damascus. So there was a lot of instability that kind of pre-existed that I really was never exposed to. So growing up in the United Arab Emirates, you are in this kind of place which is more or less, in this very turbulent region, an island of stability, at least it seemed to be, until 2011. And I would say I didn't really imagine that this kind of more or less stable life could be shaken so severely and so suddenly. But in 2014, this was like 3 years after the Arab Spring, and this is 3 years, of course, 2011, I became very active, especially on Twitter. And it was in 2014 that I was arrested and asked to leave the country. And of course, I had lived in the country, in the United Arab Emirates, since birth, really. I was almost 37 years old. I was expecting my first child. And I, being of Palestinian, born to Palestinian parents, I had nowhere to go back to. And so you can't really deport me. Where are you going to send me to? So that was, you know, that was the actual question that I asked the officers at the time, and they had no answer. But eventually, through a very convoluted set of steps and, you know, some really, I was also very fortunate with having a network that could help. I was in prison for a bit, lived in an airport for a while because I had nowhere else to go, had kind of 4 months in Malaysia waiting to process my papers. But eventually I was invited to Norway to speak at the Human Rights Conference in Oslo in 2014. And that's how Norway got stuck with me, because I applied for asylum right after that. And shortly after that, I, you know, made Norway my home.
You introduce the book, The Middle East Crisis Factory, with a list of things that, as you put it, need unlearning. These are assumptions that are often made about the Middle East. I'll ask about some of them in detail shortly, but more generally, do you think there is a sense in which the Middle East is held captive by those assumptions which are made about it, whether those assumptions are made by people within the Middle East or outside it?
Well, it's definitely a case, and that's why we had to start by a chapter called The Unlearning, as you mentioned. I've been immersed in discussions about foreign policy and about the Middle East since really before 2011, but certainly since 2011 in a public way and engaging with people from all across the world. And it was clear, very clear, that there are certain preconceived ideas that seem to be generational in nature. There seem to be certain people of certain generations who are exposed to certain news from the Middle East, and that came with a certain media narrative that colored their perspective of the region, what it is, what it isn't, what it can be, and what it cannot be. But this itself, it's kind of interacted in important ways with a prior identity crisis that we in the Middle East ourselves, the natives themselves, have, which is kind of, it really goes back to the colonial era. In 2011 and 2012, I would admit that I did not really fully appreciate the impact of colonialism. I grew up in a generation that, you know, was not ruled by the 20th century colonialists. The colonies, at least in theory, ended after the Second World War. The United Arab Emirates itself, you know, was under British protection until 1971. I was born after that. But really, as I studied the history of the region, I started to like trace back the history of these ideas. At some point, I can no longer deny that colonialism had a very big role to play. And what I mean here particularly is not the conquest itself, not the economic exploitation itself, but rather the narrative around it, the story that is being told. Because you cannot dominate a people unless you convince them that they deserve to be dominated. And this is the colonial civilizing mission, the narrative, which I see as extending right now. Because in the 20th century, we had European colonialists telling us that we cannot rule ourselves because we're not ready for self-rule. This was the narrative. We are not civilized enough. We're not, you know, developed enough to be able to rule ourselves. Now we have dictators who are backed by these very countries who tell us that we're not ready for democracy. It is the same narrative, but instead of the narrative being told to us directly by our colonialists, it is being told to us by dictators who are supported by the colonialists.
That's one of the lessons right there that you say needs unlearning, that the Middle East is faced with a choice basically between dictatorship and theocracy, that there's no other possible way that a Middle Eastern nation can be governed. Do you see that as a direct descendant of that colonial or colonialist mindset?
Yeah, I mean, that's the point here. I think that the idea here that the Middle East can only be a certain way and cannot aspire to be a certain way, this bigotry of low expectations to say that the Orient or the Oriental or, you know, it is essentialized and so essentialized as to mean very specific things. And we cannot shoot for, you know, having a liberal democracy or having an advanced economy or equality before the law. And that the only thing that is suited for us somehow is strongman rule or theocracy. I mean, this is why we had to write that short, brief chapter, The Unlearning, because we felt that if you go into the book with these preconceived ideas, you will not be able to really appreciate the history or the arguments, because you're always going to be going back to that and interpreting the entire story within that prism.
You also, and I think this is probably an important point, take pains to reject the idea that Islam and democracy are incompatible. Where do you think the idea that they are incompatible has sprung from? Again, is that an idea that has taken root within the Middle East or been imposed upon it from outside?
Well, it's a bit of both. I had an interesting conversation recently with a Syrian researcher who was looking into the origin of the idea. And, you know, she finds some of this narrative beginning really in the French-speaking world in the 19th century. The whole idea that they've only ever had that kind of governance, and whatever governance works for us does not necessarily work for them. The reason why this is a complex conversation is because in many cases, colonialism brings with it a loss of identity. It kind of brings with it an identity crisis. And the natives are always going to try to find out who they are. They always want to manifest their native agency. And sometimes it's a bit confusing because they want to construct a certain reality to say this is how we were before colonialism and we can go back to it. In many cases, this is constructed, this is false, it's fake. This whole idea that we have to go back to a simple, a more authentic, a more original state, many people in the region identified it with Islam, being, kind of the cultural language of the region, but also a super identity of many different ethnic groups in the region. And of course, I reject that as someone who does not describe himself as an Islamist. I mean, I am a practicing Muslim, but I'm not an Islamist. But at the same time, I think it's important for us to also unpack the whole idea about whether Muslim countries can become democracies. Because when we studied this for the book, we found this very interesting phenomenon, which is that the further a Muslim country is from the Middle East, the more likely it is to have democratic governance. So, for example, if you look at Indonesia, which is the biggest Muslim country by population, I wouldn't say it's a perfect democracy, but it has more or less a functioning democracy, and it's very far from the Middle East. The closer you get to the Middle East, the more messed up things begin to look. And this is the whole question that drove us towards the whole vicious triangle mechanism that I'm sure that you have questions about sooner or later.
I do, and we will come to those and the possible solutions in the second part of the show. But before we get to that, I just want to follow up that point. I suspect there isn't a short answer to the question of why is it that things become more chaotic when you get geographically closer to the Middle East? But did you arrive at any conclusions about that?
So it's really three things that intersect here. The first really is a legacy of the Cold War. And I don't want to get too much into that, but the Cold War had its own long shadow on the region. It's also, we can't deny the fact that the region is very oil rich, and so it became very important for big powers, first of all, to make sure that they have access to the oil, but also to make sure that this oil can flow safely. And again, we cannot deny that existence of Israel has been a factor here, or the very close relationship between Israel and certain Western countries that, again, a lot of this was also entangled in the Cold War, created a situation where the United States specifically is very much invested in ensuring that a certain kind of stability continues in the region.
Iyad al-Baghdadi, thank you very much for the moment. We'll have more from you later in the show. It is, of course, one thing to have ideas about fixing the Middle East. It is another thing entirely to implement them. Our next guest has had a go. Hawla Ben Aicha was, from 2014 to 2019, a member of the Parliament of Tunisia. Hawla, I want to start by thinking back to exactly what Tunisia was like 10 years ago from this weekend. This is obviously by then a few months into the Arab Spring. President Ben Ali has fled the country. The Prime Minister has quit. There's music in the cafes at night and revolution in the air. Everything is all to play for. How optimistic were you feeling at that point?
I mean, I think every Tunisian citizen was really optimistic about changing things, about having more freedom, not only freedom of expression, but freedom of investment, freedom also of traveling, of doing whatever they want. In 2011, I was 23 years old. I've never voted before, so it was also the first time I'm going to practice my civic right as an accomplished citizen. I was in France, but indeed we have the right to vote for Tunisian elections. So yeah, we were full of hope for a better Tunisia, more open and under the brand of freedom. I mean, everybody was dreaming about the Tunisia, which will be the land of freedom.
You decided at a very early point and at a very young age to go into politics. Why did you feel that that was the way forward for you? What did you want to accomplish?
Well, I decided to get involved in politics not in 2011, but in 2012, when I get disappointed of what I was seeing within the Constituent Assembly and the political class of that time. In 2011, as you may know, we had the Islamist Party, Ennahda, who won the elections, whose leaders wanted to change somehow the way of life of Tunisians. I was watching almost every day the work of the constituency, and I was disappointed because I didn't feel myself represented. I didn't see people defending the things and the dreams and the expectations I was having. So I decided to get involved, not to be a simple spectator behind my laptop, just writing some comments. I wanted to be more active. And that's why I decided to get involved in politics.
Once you were a member of parliament, and therefore once you were one of the people actually trying to work to effect meaningful change in the Middle East, what kind of things did you discover you were up against? What were the impediments, the roadblocks?
I was expecting a lot of things, but I was hit into the reality that it isn't that easy to be in politics when you are young and when you are a woman. I've been elected when I was 26 years old. So either in my political party or in the assembly in general or within the political landscape in Tunisia. So we hit to the reality that you have to make some negotiations, a lot of concessions, that things are not going the easy way we were thinking it was going. We had to make the coalition with the Islamist party. We had to make a lot of concessions. At many times, I felt disappointed. I also found some generation gap problems. As you may know, I mean, all over the world, politics are the territory, if I can say it, of men and of elder people. So whenever I wanted to do something, I was having like an answer, you are too young. You will still have time to do this after. Just let the priority to people who have more experience than you, who spend their life having a political career. So it wasn't that easy, unfortunately. And we didn't do the reforms we were expecting to do.
I guess just as a closing thought, if there is a particular point to this episode, it's trying to isolate things or ways forward that might improve the Middle East and might stop it from being the proverbial crisis factory. Do you think, especially given the experience you had of being an MP, that a greater participation by women in Middle Eastern politics could make a crucial difference? And I guess what kind of practical differences especially do you think that could make?
Well, definitely. We've seen it through our work, either in assembly or in the parliament all over the world. Women are more committed. They make a lot of efforts to work. They are less corruptible. They have better results when they are in leading positions. I can give also the examples of leading women all over the world, like the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Angela Merkel in Germany, and so many others. The Queen Elizabeth also in the United Kingdom, which is wise. I profit from this occasion to present my condolences for the loss of the Prince Philip. But even within the assembly, we had the rates of presence of women who are higher than men MPs. The results and the accomplishments of women ministers are also higher. They also make a lot of efforts to fulfill their promises. While when we have a man who is a minister or prime minister, when he makes some promises or some electoral program, there is nobody to make the follow-up and to ask him what have been done and what have been done. So definitely, I think that having more women involved in politics could make things better, not only in Tunisia, not only in the Middle East, but all over the world.
Carla Ben Aicha, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me is Iyad El-Baghdadi. Iyad, in this second part of the show, I want to talk a bit more about what the future could potentially hold. And as a springboard to that idea, of course, it is roughly 10 years, give or take, since the Arab Spring was properly underway across the Middle East. It's fair to say, I think, that a lot of what resulted in the decade since has fallen short of the hopes and expectations of the people who participated in those revolts. But did it necessarily have to be this way? Do you think there is a plausible parallel universe in which the Arab Spring did end up democratizing the region, at least much more than the region currently is?
I mean, certainly. I think that a lot of what happened was not inevitable. A lot of it really doesn't really come down to the actions of the people within the region. I think that we did our best. But really, the response from the rest of the world. I think that especially had the United States, which, of course, has at the time had tremendous leverage with a lot of its own allies in the region, especially Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and, you know, had a historical entanglement with the region, as you well know. Had they curbed their allies when it comes to their allies going on their own counter-revolutionary assault, destabilizing the region and making sure that this democratization movement is thwarted, had the United States picked a side, I think another future would have been possible. Now, at the same time, I want to say that it's difficult to describe this as a binary of a yes or no, or whether it succeeds or fails. I think it's also important to note that democratization movements or democratic transitions take time. their intergenerational nature. I mean, in the book, we kind of compare that to what happened in Europe, for example. If you take the transition from a Europe which is dominated by mostly, you know, strongman rule, not a lot of democracy, some democracy, but not a lot. If you look at the transition basically between like the duration of time between the beginning of the First World War and the end of the Second World War, that's 30 something years. That's the span of a generation. Again, that was a lot more destructive for the world order and also, you know, for human life than anything that we've witnessed in the Middle East. In the book, we kind of refer to the Arab Spring as a 30-year movement, as an intergenerational transition. We started something in 2011. Whenever there's a revolution, there's always going to be a counter-revolution. We think that things did not have to be this bad, but things were always going to take time.
You mention in the early part of the book, again in that section on things that need to be unlearned, another popular idea, I think, that has taken root in the West, that everybody should just back out of the Middle East and leave it alone to sort itself out. And you assert that it can't be fixed by leaving it alone. But what would constructive assistance or intervention even look like? Would it be a matter of, as you suggest, somebody picking a side, ideally the side of democratic reformers, and actually helping them until they win?
Yeah, so let me unpack this a little bit, because you mentioned something interesting here, which is the whole idea that, you know, let's just pack up and leave. These guys are very bitter about us being there in the first place, so why don't we just pack up and leave? And the way that I've recently described it in a Twitter conversation is, you know, imagine if, you know, someone drives a truck into your house, knocking down like two of the main beams that support the house, and the truck becomes embedded in the house such that if the truck pulls out, the house is going to collapse. Now, it's not that you actually like the truck being there. You're probably really, really pissed off about the truck being there in the first place. And probably something really terrible happened to some members of your family when that truck drove in there. But you can at the same time say, please don't pull that truck out because it's going to collapse the whole thing. So this is the analogy here. It's not so much that we like having American troops, for example, in Syria, or some American troops in Iraq, or some kind of American influence over Saudi Arabia. It's just that to disengage from the region requires a longer term view, because this, you know, we're talking about a history that goes back many decades, a history of intervention. You can't undo that in a few months and say, hey, you're on your own now. It doesn't really work that way. I think what's really needed is having the political will to really be on the side of democracy globally. We see that democracy is declining, has been declining for the past decade. This is not something which has affected only the Middle East. It's affected the entire world. It's gotten to the point where, you know, cynical actors such as Putin's Russia, for example, have felt emboldened enough to intervene in Western democracies. We've seen that if democracy is not on the march, if democracy is not defended, it's not an either or. It's not, you can't have a world which is simultaneously safe for democracy and safe for dictatorship. It doesn't work that way. If the world is not safe for democracy, it's going to be safe for dictatorships. So I think the conversation is wider than the Middle East. I think what's really required is for democratic countries to really understand that they really need to create a pro-democracy coalition and start to create a foreign policy paradigm, which is not based upon the cynical military intervention and blanket sanctions and collective punishment paradigm that existed, but also not based upon empowerment of dictators. We try to kind of outline what such a policy can look like in the book. Certainly, it's not something that is simple, but it's not impossible. But I think that it really starts with an appreciation for the size of the problem. I think if we really understand the size of the problem of authoritarianism and how it impacts. I mean, if you look at some of the biggest global problems that we're faced with right now, extreme poverty, climate change, millions of people without clean drinking water, for example, violence, terrorism, refugee waves, these are all global problems, of course. But the problem of dictatorship, in many cases, is not only is it bigger, there's a bigger proportion of the world's population which is living under dictatorship than all of these problems combined. But also, in many cases, these problems, these other global problems, are made worse or facilitated or exacerbated by the dictatorship. I think it's really a matter of political will in the end, but also before, for that political will to develop, we need to understand that this is one of the biggest problems facing the human race.
You were saying earlier that rethinking any kind of outside engagement in the Middle East and at least seeing results from it would not be easy and would not be quick, and I'm sure that's true. But especially in light of what you were just saying, this idea of declaring that the world is not safe for dictators, is there any one single dramatic step a well-meaning outside world acting in good faith could undertake, at which point I'm going to float one of my own pet theories. What if the West just basically said to Saudi Arabia, we are done with you, we are not going to indulge you any further?
Well, Saudi Arabia actually presents a good example here, because we're not talking in the theoretical here. We're talking about an actual situation where MBS has created a situation where he can at least claim that there is no internal competition for him. He's made sure that there's no internal opposition. And so we might believe that, you know, since he's going to be around anyway, we might as well deal with him. And then we have the situation where, of course, many Western countries, including the United Kingdom and the United States, have a deep relationship with Saudi Arabia, but are also starting to understand that this is problematic. And so we're left with this situation where we have to advocate policy based upon this, based upon, of course, the fact that this is someone who's distasteful and very problematic. But at the same time, you know, what do we do? Do we just pull away and we say we're done with you? Now, recently, I've argued that, interestingly, if you actually create a decision tree and look at all of the options, you find that disengagement, basically just saying, hey, we're done with you, you're on your own, actually does not produce the best outcomes. The reason why is because you don't want to create a kind of Saddam Hussein situation. You don't want to create a dictator who has nothing to lose, because when he has nothing to lose, he's going to be extremely repressive. He will be aware that he is in mortal danger, and he's going to be more repressive than ever. So what's really required is more of a kind of carrot and stick approach. What you really need to do is to say, we are able to hurt you. We have the political will to do this. Now, in order for you to avoid this, you need to do ABC. The focus in this case should really be on freedom of speech. It should really be on ensuring that society itself can liberate itself. I mean, this is kind of a theory, the theory of change really that was embraced by my late friend Jamal Khashoggi, which is that if you allow people freedom of speech, they're going to liberate themselves. They're not going to need tanks. They're not going to need weapons. They will be able to liberate themselves initially first from imposed narratives, and then they're going to demand change from their government. The first thing that dictators do, as you know, is clamp down on freedom of speech. And this is where we can curb dictators. And this is actually the most sustainable way to do it, because you don't want a long-term, diplomatically exhausting, maybe even economically exhausting campaign of pressure. The best way is to really use that leverage and make it clear that freedom of speech for the citizens of these countries is a priority, not only for them, but also for the world, because this is how you stabilize the region.
The last chapter of your book is called The Next 20 Years, and obviously the possibilities in those two decades are endless for good and for bad, especially as you point out, and again, this could be a double-edged thing, that the region's population is 60% under the age of 30. It is all to play for. But when you think ahead 20 years as realistically as possible, how different do you imagine the Middle East looking? I guess what I'm asking is, are you basically optimistic despite everything?
I mean, optimistic is a difficult word here. And this is something, by the way, that gets thrown around a lot in our internal discussions with others in our community as pro-democracy dissidents. The question we have to ask ourselves is success possible? Because if success is possible, then whether it happens in 10 or 20 or 30 years, I mean, it's still worth pursuing. If it's not possible, then what are we doing here? So really the question here is 20 years a realistic timeline? I believe 20 years is a realistic timeline, especially that I don't see that we're not starting. This is not year zero. Even 2011 was not year zero, even though, you know, 2011 was very important in the historical context, but we're still building upon, and I think we mentioned this in the book as well, we're building upon something that started a long time before. I recently had a conversation where a very esteemed colleague said something like, you should not be too optimistic. And I said, I don't think I'm being optimistic. If I say this is going to take 20 years and I say it's going to involve massive instability. I mean, what we're seeing right now is kind of an ecosystem that includes authoritarian consolidation, certain countries falling apart, civil wars, proxy wars, refugee waves, terrorism waves, but also smarter organizing, also popular uprisings, also a lot of resistance and a lot of activism. This is the ecosystem, and this ecosystem, I believe, is going to continue. It's going to be with us for a while. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be traumatic, but I think it's possible and it's worth it.
Iyad al-Baghdadi, thank you very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Yolin Goffan and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.